This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Suzanne Collins about the final book in her Hunger Games trilogy.
In the Hunger Games, I hope they question elements like the global warming, the mistreatment of the environment. How do you feel about the fact that some people take their next meal for granted and so many other people are starving in the world?
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. My colleague Greg Coles and I discuss Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Freedom.
He's not doing a whole lot that's new here. He's working in a very traditional vein. It's just that he's doing it at a level that no one else is doing it at right now.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review Podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the easy-to-use in-car connectivity system which gives you voice control of mobile phones and MP3 players and features audible turn-by-turn directions and 911 assist. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
One of the most remarkable phenomena in the publishing world today is the Hunger Games trilogy by Suzanne Collins. The series is set in the ruins of North America in a country now called Panem, consists of an all-powerful capital and 12 districts who essentially provide slave labor for them. The new book in the trilogy, Mockingjay, even before it was published, had already climbed to the top of Amazon's list. And there is currently a movie of The Hunger Games being developed. We're delighted that Suzanne Collins is here to talk about her remarkable bestseller, and our children's books editor, Julie Just, is here to talk with her, too. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Sam. Suzanne, events this year really seem to me to be playing into the setting of The Hunger Games so powerfully. The summer in New York City, climbing temperatures, fires in Russia, unrest in China. How much of the real world affected you as you've been writing the books, or do you sort of draw the blind more when you work?
Well, I draw a lot from history and mythology, but definitely real-world events influence the story. Some I can't be too specific about because I would ruin the ending for people, but I would say that currently that our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the popularity of reality television, and the state of the environment have had an effect.
The powerful center of The Hunger Games, of course, in the sequel, Catching Fire, are these sort of gladiatorial games where young people from 12 districts are sent to compete, to fight to the death. There's an aspect of that setting that evokes both sort of Project Runway and The Biggest Loser, but with weapons. There's a voyeurism in the culture now that you seem to capture in the books that I think people have responded to.
Right, and that a lot of that has to do with the nature of the gladiator game. If there's not an audience, it's not a gladiator game. The audience is a necessary component. The event was meant to be a form of popular entertainment. The audiences for both the Roman gladiator games and our current reality television shows are almost characters in themselves. They can respond with great enthusiasm to the contestants, or they can play a role in their elimination. This has been one of the most exciting aspects of putting the books on screen for me. I want to see that if you go to the movie, okay, you're going to be part of the audience in the theater, but are you going to feel like you're part of the Hunger Games audience as well? I wonder, will you be actively rooting for certain tributes to live and die? Or will you distance yourself from the whole experience? And ultimately, the question is, how much will you allow yourself to be caught up in the Capitol's game? I can't even answer that question for myself, but I'm very intrigued to see how it is for people.
So you've been working on a draft of the screenplay. Were you able to finish the third book in the trilogy that's just come out Before starting work on the screenplay, or how did you?
I was somewhat overlapping work on the beginning development of the screenplay and the treatment as I was doing the final revisions on Mockingjay. It was a busy time.
Suzanne, when J.K. Rowling's novels were turned into films, she exercised a great deal of control, but from a distance. I believe she had nothing to do with the screenplay. Was it important to you actually to write the screenplay, to translate it in a direct way to the screen?
It was important for me to do it initially. I have a background in television and script writing, so I wanted to take a shot on it just on that level. But beyond that, the third book was not only not completed, it was not available in any way to the people who were developing the film. And so I felt I also needed to be there on a certain protective level until they could see the entire arc of the trilogy, because I think of it as one story. And, you know, it'd be very easy to just look at the first book and go off in certain directions that would allow you to never reach the conclusion of the third book. So now, as we get closer to the point that Mockingjay will be available to everyone, I feel much less pressure in that area.
One of the huge strengths of the book is obviously the character and the voice of Katniss Everdeen, your heroine. She's 16, a kind of reluctant killer, but absolutely deadly in the arena, where she has to win not only for her own survival, but because it means the survival for her family, the way the games are set up. She's an utterly tough, memorable heroine. Were there inspirations for you for that character, or where does she spring out of?
I never directly base any of my characters off real people. And this was true with Katniss as well. When I sat down to write this series, I assumed it was going to be like the previous series I had written, The Underland Chronicles, which means it was written in the third person and the past tense. And when I began writing, the words just came out, not only in the first person, but in the present tense, in Katniss's voice. It was almost as if the character was insisting on telling this story herself. So I'd never really made a concentrated effort to get inside her head. She was already very much alive in mine.
And I noticed when you've read the book aloud that she has a kind of pronounced Appalachian accent. She comes from the mining district, I think the poorest district in this country that you've conceived, Panem. Where does that come out of, the Appalachian idea?
Right. Well, Katniss is from District 12, which is the coal mining region in Appalachia. So I try to give her an accent suggestive of the area. It's not very heavy when I read it. I'm not going for the contemporary equivalent because the story is set hundreds of years in the future anyway, and I feel like the language would have evolved. Panem is in the ruins of North America, which we talked about, and we know how varied our accents are at present, and I think that would still be true for someone living in Katniss's region, that they would sound different than a person living in, say, the Deep South Agricultural District or the Northwestern Lumber District. And then, of course, there's the accent of the capital. The capital is situated in the Rockies, but the people there have nurtured a very affected sound to their speech. You know, today we are exposed to so many broadcast channels, and I think that that could slowly bring about a sort of homogenization of the American accent. But that type of programming is history in Panem. There's one television channel, and it's completely controlled by the capital. And most people in the districts have absolutely no desire to adopt that accent because it's the accent of their oppressors. And choosing the manner in which they speak is one of their very few freedoms.
Suzanne, what do you make of the trend in young adult fiction for dystopias? There's still more coming next year. And it's almost as though young readers are willing to face scenarios about our future with global warming and so on that adults in Washington refuse to.
Yes, and I think that it's crucial that young readers are considering scenarios about humanity's future because those challenges are about to land in their laps. In The Hunger Games, I hope they question elements like the global warming, the mistreatment of the environment, but also questions like, how do you feel about the fact that some people take their next meal for granted and so many other people are starving in the world? What do you think about the choices your government, past and present, or other governments around the world make? What's your relationship to reality television versus your relationship to the news, for instance? Was there anything in the book that disturbed you because it reflected aspects of your own life? And if there was, what can you do about it? Because you know what? Even if they're not of your own making, these issues and how to deal with them will become your responsibility.
With all the apps and websites and enhanced ebooks that are starting to take off now, I wondered if there might be a game version of The Hunger Games in the works and how you would feel about that. And I gather that there is something going on in that way.
Yes, there is a game that has been developed. Now, my biggest concern with the game was that it not be about kids killing kids. That would have been an absolute nightmare for me. Fortunately, the real-life game makers who do the merchandising were fine with that. They have created a fantastic strategy game, and it's based on the training days, the period which lead up to the Hunger Games in the book. There's a board game. There's also an online version. And the goal is for the players who are playing tributes in it to attain the highest approval rating from the audience, and then that would then translate them into having the most sponsors when they enter the game. So there's no combat or violence in the game itself, and you will not have the experience of killing off your opponents. But it's a fantastic strategy game. But if you're like me and you tend more towards Scrabble and Bananagrams, there will be a learning curve, but it has a very satisfying payoff.
And is that out now, the game?
It is out in bookstores now, yes. And I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe that the online version, who anyone can play, anybody can play, it's free, will come out at the same time as the third book.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne Collins and Julie Just.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook listeners may enjoy is The Woody Allen Collection, Without Feathers, Getting Even, Mere Anarchy, and Side Effects, which is, of course, written and read by Woody Allen. That's The Woody Allen Collection, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
Andrew Wiley, the high-powered literary agent, is back in the news. And he and Random House have been fighting over ebook rights. What's going on here?
So this is an issue that started back in July. Random House, like other big publishers, says that it owns the rights to backlist titles, that is the ebook rights to backlist titles.
And backlist meaning like
older books whose contracts were negotiated and signed long before ebooks existed. So the question is, if a contract doesn't explicitly refer to who owns the ebooks, then is the author free to sell the ebook rights to someone else? Or does Random House, for instance, if they publish the print edition of a book, do they also automatically own the digital edition? So that is the issue.
And Andrew Wiley, on behalf of his clients, said that they have the right to issue their own ebook editions and could collect greater royalties. And this led to a big fight with Random House.
Right. The fight is really over how large or small the royalty rate is for the author. So Random House and other big publishers typically say that an author is entitled to about 25%
of an ebook.
Of an ebook.
Which is far more than they get for a printed book, right?
It depends. I think it's less than a hardcover, but more than a paperback. So Andrew Wiley and a lot of other agents are kind of going back and negotiating with publishers over, who owns the rights and how much authors should be paid for them.
And there was an impasse, Random House versus Andrew Wiley, and it's now been resolved?
Yes. So last month, when Andrew Wiley announced that he had started his own e-publishing venture called Odyssey Editions, and it started very small with 20 titles. Well, 13 of those titles happened to be books that Random House had published in print. So Random House became very angry, and the next day said, this is last month, Random House said, well, if Andrew Wiley is going to assert that he owns the rights to these books, then we are not going to sign any new contracts with the Wiley Agency and its 700 authors. So a month later, Random House announced this week in a joint statement with Andrew Wiley that Random House now owned the ebook rights to those 13 titles. So it appeared that Andrew Wiley blinked.
Oh, so he just gave in, or there's a settlement lurking here? Did they raise the royalty rates?
They did not disclose the terms of the agreement, but they did say that the terms of the agreement and the royalty rates were in line with other agreements that have been signed. So Random House kind of hinted that they did not give Mr. Wiley the 40 or 50% that he originally said that he wanted.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This episode of the New York Times Book Review Podcast is brought to you by voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system which gives you voice control of your Bluetooth-enabled mobile phone and most MP3 players. Sync features turn-by-turn directions, 911 assist, real-time traffic and weather, music with the sound of your voice, and text messages read aloud. All hands-free, so you can keep your hands on the wheel and eyes on the road. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
All of America, it seems, including the President of the United States, seems fixated on a new novel called Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, who may be the best living novelist in America. As it happens, I reviewed Freedom in the Book Review, and I'm here to talk about the novel and Franzen and gosh knows what else with my editor, that particular review, Greg Coles. Welcome, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
All right, we have talked, you and I and others at the Book Review, about the sort of group enthusiasm for this novel. Tell me how it felt to you when you read it. You read a lot of contemporary fiction. What was it like to read Franzen's novel? When did you get hooked on it?
Well, I got hooked on it really within the opening pages. I read Freedom shortly after reading another book that I liked very much, that I admired very much, but that I felt didn't have maybe the psychological depth that I was looking for. And then I started reading Freedom, and right away he gives you that kind of depth of characterization, the real psychological acuity that brings these characters to life.
And how does he do that? Because there's some striking things about this novel. For one, it's not as enameled and polished as his previous great novel, The Corrections. There's something almost conversational about it, and yet you feel you're in the hands of someone who has total command of the characters he's writing about. How does he get to those layers of depth and detail without sounding like a psychiatrist or a historian? How does he do it as a novelist?
Well, if I could tell you that.
You'd be doing it yourself.
First of all, we should describe what the book is about a little bit, just so people understand who we're talking about when we talk about the characters. It is, like his previous great book, The Corrections, a family novel, but where The Corrections was mostly about the relationship between older parents and their grown children, Freedom is mostly about the relationship between a husband and wife. And it brings their children into it, too, and, of course, their community. And it opens up in ways into the American landscape today. But at heart, it's really about the relationship between a husband and wife, the Berglunds, Walter Berglund and Patty Berglund. She married him after having a thing for his best friend during college, and she's never really let go of that thing for his best friend.
And that happened, we'll guess, maybe late 70s or around 1980 in Minneapolis-St. Paul, where the novel opens.
And he set them up in that particular moment. They're very young people. They're college people, kind of the beginning of the Reagan years.
That's right.
Then he carries us all the way through actually the beginning of the Obama years. In some ways, though, it's a novel about the Bush years.
Very much so. The Corrections was essentially a novel of the Clinton years. This one, Freedom, you think of Operation Iraqi Freedom, kind of the role that freedom as an abstraction and an American ideal plays in our culture. And it's something that he's exploring very much in this book, but without being abstract about it. He crystallizes it through this family and through the individuals. You asked how he brings them to life. One way that he does it very effectively and maybe a little boldly is he gives a big part of the book over to autobiographical writing, a journal essentially, that the wife, Patty Berglund, keeps at the advice of her therapist.
And she writes it in the third person. So she calls herself Patty.
She does. She's the athlete in a family of artists and would-be intellectuals, but it turns out that she has a real talent for writing about herself. And the autobiography really goes deep into her own motivations in life. We see the characters come to life through their actions. I mean, really just in the way that great writers have done it from Flaubert and Tolstoy on. It's very much a novel of psychological realism, and Franzen has absolute control of those talents.
He also, I think, even more powerfully in this novel than The Corrections, creates really vivid, memorable scenes that stay in the mind.
That's true.
Conflicts, confrontations, they can be very ordinary. Sometimes it's just an argument between Patty and Walter, and it feels so real, but it doesn't seem just grabbed from the sort of base realism the way you might see on television or in a film. There's still something larger about it. And I wonder, is it because he's made these characters, for all their many complex human sides, somehow archetypal?
Absolutely. I mean, in a way that he didn't in The Corrections. The Corrections, those characters felt more unique. Here, Walter is kind of your middle-class lawyer, very steady. Patty is the dissatisfied housewife and former athlete, not sure what she wants to do with her life anymore. Richard Katz, the best friend and outside love interest, is a rock star. And so you have these real archetypes who could become just caricatures. So we recognize them as archetypes and caricatures, but then he gives them the freedom to become real people.
It struck me that, I don't know how consciously he did it, but the characters take on the size that characters do in Dickens or Tolstoy, who's a tremendous influence in the novel. And Franzen announces at various places that War and Peace is a model for this book. Also the way Saul Bellow does, makes characters that are larger than life at the same time they feel absolutely recognizably human. Franzen's own theories of the novel, which he's expressed more than once, are not necessarily so different from what many novelists have to say about their work. Somehow he just has the ability to do it on the page with the story he's telling.
Sure. He's not doing a whole lot that's new here. He's working in a very traditional vein. He has announced that that is his intent. It's just that he's doing it at a level that no one else is doing it at right now.
And Greg, also, again, reminding me of those great predecessor novelists, his command of the culture he's describing, his ear, his eye. He knows the latest technology.
Sure.
He knows the jargon. I was struck. I just dropped my only child off to college for her first year. And in the course of investigating colleges, we learned that freshmen aren't called freshmen any longer. They're called first years.
Right.
And Franzen knows that. He doesn't have any kids himself. He absorbs all the news in the culture somehow.
Right. I mean, that's the kind of thing that someone like Tom Wolfe aims to do. It's capturing the zeitgeist. And Franzen brings that into his books absolutely. I mean, he's not just creating a story of a family. He's also trying to create a story of a time and place. And it's very much an American novel and a look at who we are today.
I was struck by how much of the novel is set in one particular year, 2004. Why do you think he chose that year?
It was a pivotal year politically. It was the end of Bush's first term, a time when the country is very anxious about terror and very polarized politically. After the Clinton years and then the first 4 years of Bush and the whole Bush versus Gore, the country had really splintered. And I think that he saw that as an opportune time to explore.
One of the great sentences in the novel, I wish I'd quoted it in my review, I think I had it in an earlier draft, is when Walter and Patty's son Joey, who actually becomes a young Republican on the make, thinks to himself that his own tensions with his father, their ideological differences, are reflections of a psychological hatred they've developed for each other. And it seems such a important theme for Franzen is he wants even the ideological positions people take to somehow grow out of their identities as people.
Sometimes to a fault. I think that Franzen is so interested in explaining everyone's personality traits that, for instance, Walter, who's politically intransigent, very stubborn as an individual, there's a chapter where Franzen traces that back through the generations of his stubborn Nordic forebears.
Right, the male depressives.
Yes, exactly. And it doesn't let Walter be his own person, but says, oh, see, it comes, you know, it's all genetically predetermined in a way that felt Freudian and maybe overdone.
Yeah, there is an overdetermined quality to some of what he does. Also the politics, and we should be clear, Franzen's politics are not a secret. He's a kind of left-winger, preoccupied with environmentalism, endangered species, anti-globalization. It's a politics that's familiar to us, and yet Franzen somehow brings it alive so that the politics in a way becomes more substantial than it might otherwise.
Right. All of those things are in the book. The environmentalism is absolutely a theme. Overpopulation, absolutely a theme. But he is not standing on a soapbox. He lets these issues come to life through the characters and their own belief systems in a way that feels like he's not preaching to you.
And Greg, what about Franzen, the technician of the novel, the overlapping stories, how he advances the narrative, how he goes backward and forward? Are we looking at someone who has absolutely mastered the form in its current state?
I think we are. It's a very artful novel. The ending echoes beautifully with the beginning in a way that the beginning pulls you in and you don't anticipate that he will reprise it again by the end, but he does. That you get in the beginning the neighbor's perspective on this family, and in the end you again get a different set of neighbors' perspective on the same family in a way that reflects all the changes that have happened throughout the course of the novel, but that very much resonates with what he's set up before. And there are overlaps like that throughout, little stories that pick up off of other stories, subplots that reflect the bigger plot going on. So yeah, he's really got it down.
Is this an advance over the corrections?
Personally, I think it is. I've talked to some other readers who liked the corrections better, and they indicated that that's because they had their own parent-child issues. So, you know, maybe it just depends where you approach the books from. But I think this is a more successful novel. I loved the corrections. I think the corrections is a masterpiece. But I think this does represent an advance.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Thank you, Sam.
Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
So what's new on the list this week?
Not a lot of news at the top. Justin Halpern still on top of the nonfiction list with Stuff My Dad Says, followed by Laura Ingraham's Obama Diaries. And Stieg Larsson, we will never be rid of him, still on top of the fiction list with The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest.
Now, what about Jonathan Franzen? Has he left Martha's Vineyard and reached the great American public?
Sam, enough already about Jonathan Franzen. You male literary book review editors are obsessed with this guy. I don't know what your problem is. But seriously, not yet. The book is not actually officially on sale until Tuesday. And when President Obama, on his vacation in Martha's Vineyard, walked out of a bookstore with a copy of it, a bit of a frenzy erupted because it was mistakenly reported he had bought the book. Actually, he was given a free advanced reader's edition, so no, the rest of the world couldn't lay their hands on it yet. This is only one of the aspects of the utter frenzy around this book. You've probably heard about Jennifer Weiner, the novelist, who's been out there working her Twitter feed, just working the blogs, working the media, with her complaint that book review editor, specifically you, your book review is paying way too much attention to this guy, and we should give some of the love to the great women writers who are out there writing books that are selling millions of copies. Writers like, for example, Jennifer Weiner. She's got this very active Twitter feed. She's extremely funny. She doesn't like us very much. This is what she had to say this week. NYT, sexist, unfair, loves Gary Steingart, hates chick lit, ignores romance, and now to go weep into my royalty check.
Ooh. Why? Because she's making out very well. She doesn't really need us so much, does she?
Yes, and actually her latest novel, Fly Away Home, is number 10 on the list this week. It's been out there for about 5 weeks. And Jodi Picco, another tremendously successful novelist, has also jumped into the debate. You know, she's saying that, you know, the Times in particular were really the butt of all this. You know, isn't paying enough attention to books people actually want to read? And, you know, this is what she said in an interview. Think about Jane Austen. Think about Charles Dickens. Think about Shakespeare. They were popular authors. They were writing for the masses, you know, and yet their equivalents today are being ignored. But of course, you could actually say kind of the same thing about Jonathan Franzen. You know, The Correction sold almost 3 million copies, which probably stacks up pretty favorably next to the sales of any single book by Jen Weiner or Jodi Picco.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.